Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, June the 10th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Chuck Huff, continuing his series on psychological fallacies. Today's session is entitled Reason Can Solve Conflict. Let's listen in.
My name is Chuck Huff. And this is the first in a series of sessions this week on psychological fallacies. And the psychological fallacy that I want to talk about today is that reasonable people can solve their conflicts. Put another way, and I often hear this said, if people would just be reasonable, they could work that out. Before we get into all of that, I'd like to issue a couple of caveats. Those of you who have heard these before can go get a cup of coffee now. I'm a social psychologist, which means that I study how people get along with each other, or don't, as the case may be. I study how people perceive each other and think about themselves and about the other or other people. I look at how groups get along and work together or don't work together. A lot of my research has been on how computers change organizations, but that's a whole nother set of topics that we might do at another time. My expertise on these psychological fallacies comes from a lot of reading of the psychological literature, a fair amount of teaching and talking with students and other people in churches about what they think is true and what they think isn't true. And from some work in organizations about how they might reorganize or change the way they do things to work better. I don't want to pretend that I'm the only person in this room with expertise. I'm the only person who gets to say at the beginning of the session, my name is. But all of you have some expertise on dealing with other people. And what I would like to do as we have these conversations is for you to think of the expertise that you have. Think of the connections in your life to the kinds of things that we're talking about. And I hope that what we can have is a reasonably open discussion about these things. Some of the topics are going to be difficult. On Wednesday, I'm going to be talking about the reliability of memory, and that's going to get into some currently very controversial issues on things like recovered memories of childhood abuse and those sorts of things. And so I ask that as we talk about these issues that I know are deeply meaningful to a lot of people, that you ask yourself where your expertise comes from, and I will ask myself that, and we can talk about the limitations of our individual knowledge and perhaps pull them together. So if we end up disagreeing on things, which I hope we will, because that often something useful comes out of that, I'd like us to think together about why it is that we disagree. When I said I was going to do a series on fallacies, I thought it would be important to talk about what I mean by a fallacy. And I don't mean something that's simply wrong. It's usually not the case that it gets that easy. The kinds of fallacies that I'm going to be talking about are things that are popularly believed, but that are usually more complicated than the common wisdom suggests that they are. And that's going to be the case with the topic for tonight, which is that reasonable people can solve conflicts. Of course, being reasonable helps to solve conflicts, sometimes under limited circumstances. And the issue is to figure out when the sometimes are and what the circumstances are that limit making reason a useful thing in conflict. Well, now I have to flip past all of my notes on the wedding ceremony. I won't read them.
You're on a single track?
Earlier I had talked, last week we had talked about the theme that, or the thought that all you needed was love. And this topic is like that one in structure, in that very often people think in a conflict all you need is reason. All you need, if people would just sit down and talk out how they feel about things, things would work. I want to suggest there are at least two complicating factors. I'm sure there's more, but I think these two might be worth talking about. One of them is motivation. That is the motivation of the, for the, right now, let's assume, just for the conversation, that when we're talking about a conflict, we're talking about two people or two parties. It's often not that simple. Sometimes there's three and four and five parties, and that makes life a little harder. But many of these comments work with those multiple situations too. The motivation of both of the parties. And another complicating factor I want to talk about is the basic interests of the different parties. Let me start with basic interest. And some of y'all heard some conversation about basic interests last week. One of the things that often happens in conflict is that people stake out a position and end up identifying their position as the thing they have to hold on to. One of the first rules that you'll find in almost all of the books on negotiation is that what you need to do is to figure out what your basic interests are and commit yourself to those rather than committing yourself to any particular way of gaining your basic interests. So it's helpful to think about the difference between the basic interest that you have in a conflict and the particular way that right now you think you can get your basic interests resolved. An easy example of this is a teenager who wants to have a motorcycle so that he can ride it around and impress all of his friends with the noise that it makes. I was like that. In fact, the basic interest of the teenager is impressing his friends. And we could identify an even more basic interest than that if you felt like it. Interests come in layers. They're not all or nothing. And so very often as we solve a conflict, it appears that there's a conflict on the surface because mom and dad don't want the motorcycle and Junior does. But we might be able to find some deeper level at which both parties' basic interests can be resolved. Let me give you a couple of examples of instances where it looks like things are at loggerheads or opposites, when in fact they might not be. These I've stolen from a book that if you are interested in conflict and conflict resolution, you might want to get. The authors are Fischer, F-I-S-C-H-U-R, and Ury, U-R-Y. And the title of the book is Getting to Yes. It's a very good book on negotiation. They're part of the Harvard Negotiation Project. They've done a lot of work on issues in negotiation. But I've stolen these from their book. I don't claim to have made them up. For instance, one party might be concerned with substance, and the other party might be concerned with form. Often you get conflicts between people where the issue is, for one person, the propriety of how it looks to the world. And for other people, the issue is really what's actually happening on the issue. Sometimes you will find conflicts between people who are interested in the symbolism of a particular action or a possible action, and people who are interested in actually what goes along. And many times those kinds of differences can be resolved once people realize that they aren't in fact at loggerheads. If they ask themselves, do we really have a conflict in interest? Let me give you an excellent example. After the 1973 desert war between Israel and Egypt, Israel had overrun the Sinai, right? They had all of it. That's that big desert that didn't exist between Israel and Egypt. And this was a major issue between the two parties if they were going to try to come to some sort of a peace agreement. It turned out, after long, arduous hours of negotiation, that what really was at issue was that Egypt wanted to look to the world like it was in control of the roads on the Sinai. And Israel wanted to actually be in control of the roads on the Sinai. And so they worked out a deal so that Egypt had, so that Egypt put the people at the crossing points, and they had their tanks out there and they looked like they were controlling the road. And just over the hill, the Israelis had 30 tanks and all of their troops, so that at a moment's notice, they could actually be in control of the road if they really cared. What they did was cut a deal, realizing that in fact, they didn't have a difference of opinion, because one person cared about symbolism. They wanted to look like it worked. And the other party cared about what actually was going on. That sounds easy. Once a friend of mine and I were talking about programming in a particular language on a particular machine, and I asked him whether it was hard or difficult, and he said, "Oh, it's easy once you know how." And it you know, that solution for that problem sounds easy once you say this party was really interested in that and the other party was really interested in the other thing. The real work is figuring out what each party is really interested in. And even one of the reasons why it's hard, why the real work is there. One of the reasons And this is a very realistic one, rather than just a cognitive limitation like we can't think of what's really going on, is that it can often be dangerous for me to tell you what my basic interests are if I don't trust you. Right? If I'm not sure that you have my best interests in mind, why, you might be able to use the information I give you to hurt me. You could go tell my mother, who's coming on Wednesday, what I just said about what, and you could hold me hostage with that information that I gave you. So I don't want at all to act like it's easy to do this work of finding out what basic interests are, because people have many, many reasons to hide their basic interests from other people with whom they have a disagreement, particularly with other people with whom they have a disagreement. But I do want to at least suggest that one of the places to begin looking when you're in a conflict is to begin looking at basic interests. Now, having already talked about the fact that some problems in basic interests can be resolved because the basic interests really aren't really at odds, well, that brings up, of course, the other side. You can do the hard work, find out that what the both parties' basic interests are. Oh, and by the way, it's not easy even to figure out what your own basic interests are, because it's very easy for us to become attached to a particular program just because we think it's cool and interesting and we thought of it, rather than to think harder about our own interests and what really we care deeply about. Dan, in the conversation we were having in this room just before, talked about discovering some of his basic identity in his interaction with his mother in the nursing home, and that was really it. And it took him a long time to come, instead of all of his academic, etc., qualifications. Once he was alone with his mother in the nursing home. But it wasn't until then that he realized that that was really at the core of who he felt he was. Yes?
Chuck, I'm hoping you're going to, but I'm wondering if my question will lead you to help us. If, for the examples you're giving,
sure,
are between two people,
right,
9 times out of 10, we're not going to have a third person negotiator in the middle like Israel and Egypt did.
Right.
To help us figure out our basic interests. And
that's right.
If you're not going to tell me your basic interests, and I don't trust you, and so I'm a little leery.
Right.
How do we get there? I mean, who is going to help us? We don't have the option of a negotiator.
Right.
Are you going to look at some of those?
Well, in fact, one of the things I suggest to people is that they work within the communities that they have to set up people who will be willing to be mediators, and there are programs to train people to do mediation. I think this would be a great service of local churches to help people talk with each other through conflict and find out what basic interests are and to work these things out. So that's not really an answer, I know,
yeah,
but it was a thing that I wanted to say. There are some things that you can do by yourself to begin establishing trust. There's a model called GRIT, which I like because I'm from Georgia. Although it's GRITS is the one I really care about. But GRIT is graduated and reciprocal reductions in tension. And I suggest, if you're really interested in these topics, that you get this book. It's called Social Conflict. by Reuben Pruitt and Kim. It's a very, it's even written in English. And it's thin. And they talk some about the grit model and take you through it a little bit and also give you the basic references for it. But one of the things that the grit model suggests is that you think about concessions you can make to the other person that you can live with if they don't work. So you think about a way you can give a unilateral evidence of your goodwill. But you don't do it all, right? You don't give in. What you say is, what can I do that will show that I have goodwill, but that won't really hurt me if they decide to take advantage of me? The Soviet Union did this in the 1980s in terms of the withdrawal of some tanks. And of course, many people on our side didn't believe, really, that they were trying to reduce tension by withdrawing the tanks. So it doesn't always work to do this. But one of the things you do is you announce ahead of time you're going to do it. And you do it regardless of what they do. Because, of course, what you want to do is establish trust. And if you say you're going to do it and then you don't, you've made it worse rather than better. And then, after you've done it, you invite them to reciprocate. Sometimes they don't. But that's at least, you know, that's at least one clue of how to get started. But it may well be that they won't reciprocate for a whole lot of the reasons that we're going to talk about tonight. But the grit model is one useful one for establishing trust. And because what you do is you say ahead of time that you're going to do it, you say why you're doing it. You say, I'm doing it because I want to establish trust between us, and I want to indicate to you that I really do care. And that I'd like to work something out so that we both get what we need. And then you follow through on it, and then you invite them to reciprocate. I don't know if that helps.
Yeah, I didn't want to get you off track, but I wondered if you were going to do
sure.
it. Sure. So that's good.
Yeah, that's at least one way to think about it. And there are others that we can talk about later. But it may well be that instead of some kind of a disagreement that's easy to resolve, that you've got to really do have a disagreement in basic interests. Management wants to pay workers less. Workers want to be paid more. They don't want to look like they're getting paid more. They actually want to be paid more. Some people want Jerusalem for their country, and other people want Jerusalem for their country. There's only one. Bless you. It may well be the case that once you get down to an analysis of your basic interests, that there really is an irreconcilable difference. But at least you know then what's going on. And then you can ask yourself, do I want to back off of what I think my basic interests are? Do I want to contend and say that, you know, we're going to fight for our basic interests because we think it's really crucial? Martin Luther King ended up deciding in the South to fight for what he thought were his basic interests. And he knew very often that it was his basic interest versus the basic interests of the white community that was in power. And so instead of problem solving with them, which is the kind of thing we're talking about, he decided to escalate. Now, he didn't escalate by shooting people, but he did escalate. He made things worse for the people in power by marching and making sure to do it where you could see it on the television and all those sorts of things. Here's another sort of side lesson in this. And that is that problem solving may not always be the strategy of choice. There may in fact be times when it's important to escalate in order to convince the other people that you're really serious about your basic interests. And then maybe you can get something done. But what you need to do is to do that intentionally rather than simply to do it in anger. You need to do it thoughtfully rather than to do it precipitously. Gosh, that's the hard part. That's the part that takes years of practice. And that a nice thin book, even if it's written in English, may not be able to help you with unless you go back. Unless what you do is to go back to it and just have it remind you of things. Let me suggest another couple of things having to do with motivation that may determine the kinds of strategies that other people will use and that we will use when we're in a conflict. I apologize for the way I'm dressed. This is dish team regalia. And since I wanted to go to the series on baptism, my choice was shower or baptism. I said, I'll do the baptism.
Aren't they the same?
I want to lay this out conceptually. If we can think of this axis as your concern, or the other person, and we can think of this axis as your concern for your own outcome. And the further out you go on the axis, the higher it is. What we find looking over a whole range of studies, both field and in the lab, is if you're highly concerned for the other person's outcome and you're highly concerned for your own outcome, the strategy you're most likely to use is problem solving. Think of this, for instance, in a marriage. You are highly concerned both about your outcome and the other person's outcome. You are highly concerned about your outcomes and the other person's outcomes, often in a close community, like at Holden, or like in a church. Within your family, it's often the case. Now, These are things that we think of as on average being true. There are, of course, exceptions. There are some people whose first reaction is to contend, right? Who always think of the world as competitive, and they'll even compete with their husband or their wife if they think that's the last piece of lasagna. If your concern for yourself is high and your concern for the other isn't very high, obviously, it's no problem contending. An easy example of this is organizations versus individuals who are asking them to fix a faulty product. They'll send you to their lawyers much sooner than they will if they really did care about their customers. If you don't care very much for the outcome, and you do care about the other person's, very often you will find yielding. Did I spell that right?
Yes.
Thank you. Need a spell checker on my board. If really you don't care at all, you often will find avoiding withdrawal or inaction. Let me give an example of these. In an organization, when a problem is brought to light, say by the employees, the powers that be in the organization can win simply by avoiding. Right? They can win and get what they want simply by not addressing the issue. Because, of course, things are the way they designed it. And so they get what they want. When you're faced with that sort of thing, then the next question you have to ask yourself is, how do we get them to care about our interests?
Sometimes you have to take them to court.
Sometimes you have to take them to court. Sometimes you have to contend. Sometimes you simply have to make their life difficult for them. This is what Martin Luther King did. And so, this is a word that as Christians, we often, I think, put too loving a slant on, and I'd like to suggest a more crass way to think about trust. You can trust another person to care about your interests if it's in their interest to care about your interests. Shall I do that again?
Yes.
You can trust another person to care about your interests if it's in their interest to care about your interest. And so by taking them to court, you can make it in their interest to care about your interests. I have a good friend of mine in Northfield who, as a lawyer, says that his job is to keep his clients out of court. And so what he does as a lawyer is he goes to either, whether it's the criminal law or it's the civil law, he goes to the other parties involved and says, let me make you an offer and let me convince you that it's in your interest to do something that's in my client's interest. Now, I don't want to suggest that we drop all of these nice thoughts that we have about trust and love and faith and all these things being connected to each other. But if what you're doing if you're in a social conflict with other people, you may not necessarily need to get them to love you first. But it may be best to make it in their interest to care about your interests, and you might actually get to love at some point as trust builds. But to make the outcome of the conflict work for both parties, you can think more strategically about what trust is. And it doesn't have to be a warm, fuzzy feeling. Trust can simply be knowing that the other person cares about you because it's important for them to. Yeah?
Yes, I wanted to put a different slant on the concern for others and avoiding withdrawal and inaction.
Sure.
I would like to put it on a more personal basis on what I find myself doing with my spouse. A lot of times things are of real concern for him.
Yes.
And he's... It's not necessarily, it involves me because we're married, but it has no significance to me.
Right.
And so it's not, I mean, I let him, you know, vent and I let him talk, but I avoid, I withdraw, and there's no action on my part because I figure if this is the way he wants to do it, it makes no difference to me.
Right.
And so we keep our marriage on a fairly even keel, mm-hmm. otherwise. And sometimes people will just put you up just for to throw out ideas for a feedback, you know.
Right.
And sometimes it's all it's all about.
Right.
Sometimes this conflict is this conflict isn't as deathly as we think it is, but we could make it more deathly.
Yes.
Because I'm so opposite that of him, and I problem solve so much differently than he does.
Right.
I just, for 44 years I've been doing this and it works, you know, but there are some things I will not. There are some
yes.
things I will not, but other things
yeah,
I
Yeah, and that's
learn.
If they're out here.
Yeah, I've learned.
For you.
Yeah, I've learned, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it can be a very positive thing. It can be very positive.
And it's also true that after 44 years of unmangling the toothpaste tube, it can get to you. And so it might finally break you, and you'll say, I can't take it anymore.
Oh,
and then maybe what you can do is to talk about.
No, you buy two
tubes. That's right.
Of
you and you work through that issue.
Isn't it?
You can call it the right way and the wrong way, but if you care about the symbolism of the issue, right? In this categorization that I'm giving you, this is the thing we do on like the second day of my class at St. Olaf when we talk about conflict resolution. And I do a semester-long course on it, and it's only really an introduction to all of the issues that are in this area, so there's no way we can go over all of this. But you're right, it can be much more complicated than that. One of the things that, and I suspect that this may well be what's happening, one of the things that is important to do, particularly in long-term relationships with others, is to let people know that you're yielding. Because very often they don't even know that you've yielded, and then it rankers in you. And you don't even get any credit. But you need to let the other person know, well, it mattered some to me, but it really didn't matter that much, so I let you go ahead and do it. And very often you'll get a thank you, and you may even get a gold star. That brings up another quick comment I want to make, and that is that we very often talk about conflict as though there were only one conflict, and that the thing to do is to solve that one. When in fact, what we find out is with most of the people that we're with, we are in long-term relationships, and if we try to win that conflict, that might hurt us at a later time. It's one of the reasons why in my class, when I have students role-play conflicts, that I make sure that they do three of them over the term. Because if they sneak and cheat on the first one, then they find out on the second conflict how well people will deal with them. And I tell them in the role-play that it's perfectly fine for you to lie, cheat, sneak, steal, do whatever you think would be in your interest. Simply remember that there is a second conflict. There is a second negotiation that you're going to have to go through with those people. You have to think about what your interests are and how to behave based on those interests. You also have to think about what you think is the ethical thing to do. Let me go through some relatively straightforward steps in problem solving. Now that's only this section up here. There's a whole bunch of things to say about how to contend. There's good and bad ways to contend. And one of the things that we did last week in talking about conflict not being bad was to talk about escalating a conflict not being bad. It can be the right thing to do to sue them or to march. Or to bring it up before the board. But again, what you have to do is to do it intentionally, to choose to do it. When I talk about, though, this time, what we might do under problem solving. One of the first things that you want to do under problem solving is you want to ask yourself, is there a conflict? Remember, that's some of that first stuff we were talking about, basic interests. It might well be the case that, in fact, there isn't a conflict in your basic interests, but that there is a relatively easy way to resolve things. It might be that this is certainly true. Perception is everything in a conflict. And it might be that you perceive that there's a difference in interest. And be very careful then in that first step based on your perceptions. Because in that first step that you take, you might create a conflict where there wasn't one before. Because now they'll perceive you based on that action that you took. Right? In the social science jargon, we call this the self-fulfilling prophecy. You suspect the other person will be competitive, and so you try to do the first strike, and you're competitive first, and lo and behold, they're competitive then. Gosh. I mean, that's the way people will respond when you're competitive right out of the dock. So you end up with people you end up with people who do this competitive thing right out of the dock, thinking that everyone else in the world is competitive. And they're right. Everyone else in their world is competitive because they've created their world in which everyone has to respond to them in that way. But people who don't compete initially right out of the dock find out that there are some people who will cooperate with you and others who won't. And so they have a different perception of the world. And so your perceptions of the world can rule the way you actually live in the world, and it can create the situation for you. So the first thing you need to ask is there a conflict? The second thing that you need to do, and none of these things, A-N-A-L-Y-Z-E, right?
Right.
Okay.
It's your spell check.
Yes, that's my spell check. I do this at school all the time, too. Interests. Is to analyze your own basic interests. This is not easy. And very often, you don't really find out what your own basic interests are until you're far in to the conflict. You realize it doesn't work, and you say, gosh, I better go back to the drawing board and figure out what's going on. Set high aspirations and be ready to stick to them. Now, as advice, what that does is it increases the probability of conflict. I don't want to fool you here. This is not going to make conflict go away. This advice increases the probability of conflict occurring because you've set high aspirations. You know what you want. But it also increases the likelihood of getting a good solution with the other person. We can give examples of how that works in international negotiations. If you're interested, I can talk about how that works in laboratory studies. But in all the research that's been done, people who set high aspirations and are willing to stick to them early in a conflict get better resolutions. and it's not to do this. Because if you get a resolution of a conflict that serves my basic interests and serves your basic interests, we're likely to have an agreement that lasts longer than one in which I give in early and then find out in a year that I'm really not very happy with what went on, then we go back to it again. Does that make sense? I don't see any heads nodding. It's not easy. But in fact, what it can do is to produce a better solution later. So I'm not giving you advice that makes conflict go away. I'm giving you advice that's long-term.
In other words, you're saying that the quality of what you're after is, I mean, this high aspirations equals the quality of what you're
for. Of a solution, that's right.
Right. And if that quality better really be good quality.
That's right.
Because you're paying a big price for it.
That's right. That's right. If you get a sloppy solution, an easy solution, you may find out you don't like it after a couple of months.
Yeah, right. It falls apart and the seams come apart.
That's right.
And you bought it at the flea market.
Or you negotiated it at the flea market.
Yeah, right.
That's right.
Yeah.
But this is harder to do.
Sure.
Because what you have to do initially is to get more uncomfortable. Yeah.
In church fights, I think sometimes that's my role as pastor to up the ante when there is a conflict, to say things like, this is what the mission statement of our congregation says, this is what the history of what we've done as a community has been in this area, and some people start squirming because I've upped the ante.
Yes.
And I'm saying, sometimes I've even said, maybe we're not who we used to be, maybe we need a new mission statement, you know, and it's upping the ante in the conflict to say, let's take the high road and what are we going to do?
That's right, but it's a very difficult, dangerous, and frightening thing to do, but in the end, if you do it well, you produce a better outcome than you would otherwise.
But the blood pressure goes up in the meantime.
Oh, yes.
You just feel it in the room.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, and yours goes up, too, I suspect, because it's very hard to say those things.
It's a threat for everybody.
But the quality of the ending agreement is crucial, is crucially dependent upon this step. If you don't set high aspirations, then you usually are much less happy with the outcome afterwards. Partly, it's setting high aspirations that gives you motivation to spend lots of energy problem solving. If you set low aspirations, well, you can get it on the first round. But if you set high aspirations, you go, oh my Lord, we are in deep trouble now.
I think Chuck, though, in business, I look at it in business, litigation in business is so expensive today, folks.
Oh, yes.
That you're better off to try to find some quick common ground because of the cost of it. It's so expensive that you just...
Well, it depends upon what the cost is for you.
Yeah, it could drag out, Chuck, and
that's right.
It could cost tens of thousands of dollars.
And that's right. So it depends, really, upon how important the issue is.
Right.
And in some issues, it's really not worth the cost, particularly with litigation. Now, it might be worth the cost if you can talk before litigation.
Yeah.
It might be worth it to set high aspirations before litigation. And once litigation comes up, then to say, it's not really that important to me, and yield.
Yeah.
you need to be careful establishing a pattern like that because people do go back and look. And you might be inviting more litigation in the future if you use that strategy all the time. But you're right, litigation can be just incredibly expensive. It's one of the reasons that I am a firm advocate of many of the arbitration and mediation programs that various jurisdictions have set up. In the state of Minnesota now, you can do a divorce with mediation. And you don't have to get your lawyers to duke it out. They still recommend that you get a lawyer to read the thing after the mediation, which is not a bad idea.
I did that. And I had a very good friend that was a lawyer, and I asked him about that. He said, absolutely. He said, if you can avoid using attorneys, avoid it at all costs.
That's right.
Because it's an arbitrary system, and he said, my job is to get as much for my client as I can.
That's
at
right.
Your cost.
That's right.
The person's cost. So he was much in favor of using mediation.
That's right. And this, by the way, is one of the dangers of escalation. Is escalation can be very, very costly. And once you get into escalation, it can be very hard to back out of it. And lawyers, if you don't choose them right, are specialists at escalation. And lawyers themselves talk about two different schools of lawyering. And there is the school of lawyering that is the attack dog. And there's the school of lawyering that is the mediator. The next step in this set is then, based on your analysis of your basic interests, to seek an integrative solution. Let me unpack the word integrated. I almost always recommend to people that they never compromise. Now, that doesn't mean what Newt Gingrich means when he says that. We have come to use compromise in our system of government to mean simply any negotiated solution. But the more narrow meaning of the term compromise is that I give a little and you give a little. And what may happen in that narrow kind of compromise is that you may both get less than what you want. So you may both come away unhappy with a compromise agreement. It might well be the case that you could both come away with all of what you want if you simply worked a little harder on identifying underlying issues and on identifying solutions. Let me give a trivial example. And this is, again, out of the Getting to Yes book. Two people are arguing over what to do with an orange because one person wants to eat the orange and the other person wants to make a cake. One solution, of course, is to cut the orange in half, which would be a compromise, and for each of them take half of the orange. The best solution in most cake recipes that call for orange is, in fact, for one of the persons to get the peeling and the other person to get the inside. And then the person who wants to make the cake gets the peeling and can use the peeling to make a fine cake that has an orange flavor. So that's an example, a trivial example, but at least one that suggests to you that compromise might not always be the best option. There may be times, and I suggest that there are more of them than we think they are, when compromise will actually get both of you a worse solution than you could have gotten had you been willing to negotiate a little bit and to think a little harder about what the basic interest of each party was. But we are such a slave to our cultural definitions of what fairness is, that we fall initially into one of two solutions. Compromise is one, and deciding on a procedure for who will win is another. And I suggest that if you can, that you avoid both of those. There's a couple of procedures for deciding who will win. You can flip coins, you can vote, you can go to court. You can draw straws. There's just a whole raft of ways of deciding on a procedure for who will win. But what that ends up doing is taking all the creativity out of the solution. And you're not looking for an integrative solution, a solution that integrates your basic interests in their basic interests. And so the first thing I suggest that people do who are involved in these kinds of conflicts is to commit themselves to not try those easy solutions, compromising or deciding on a procedure for who will win, until they've tried other ways of working out the problem. You may find out that you have to go back to some of those, but it's worthwhile attempting to do the integrative solution first, to look through your basic interest, to think about the other person's basic interest, to offer graduated and reciprocal reductions in tension, to talk with others about what good solutions have been in the past to these sorts of problems. There's a whole raft of ways to get ideas. Very often, by the way, one of the things that keeps us from trying is because we think we're not good at it. But this is true in spiritual life, too. If you think you're not good at it, you don't try, and so you don't get any better at it. And so you continue to think you're not good at it. And you never learn how to pray. And it becomes true. And the only way to become better at it is to try. And it can be frightening to try. But it's, I suggest, worthwhile. Now the last step is really pretty easy. And that is, if step three doesn't work, go back to step two. Think about your basic interests. Maybe you need to lower your aspirations and try again. Or maybe you haven't really analyzed your basic interests as well, or their basic interests as well as you should have. And I suggest you try that two or three times before you jump immediately to compromise as a solution. There are a whole bunch of interesting arbitration and mediation approaches that we can talk about as ways of producing integrative agreements. Particularly in distrustful atmospheres. And those are the hardest ones, where you don't trust the other party. In the end, I think what often matters is perseverance, trying again. And it's easy to give up. I am sorry, I have taken up almost all the time by talking. I hope I won't drive you away from any of the other sessions. But I hope you found this interesting. One of my problems when I do conflict in one session is that I end up feeling like I have to dump all of this stuff out. So please excuse me. I hope you got something out of it. Mm-hmm. Good night.
Very interesting.